This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and with me is Richard Hartice and Tom Vase. Richard is from Connecticut, Tom is from Brussels, and they have collaborated on a beautiful book that is really a work of art. Richard Hartice, what's the title of the book and what's in it?
Well, it's now called Pandemie, which is the Dutch word for pandemic. And it's 8 new poems that augment a previous collection called Plague Poems. This is the previous collection. And this is the current book called Pandemie.
Mm.
As Tom's the linoleum cutting on the front. It's like a, I don't know, like Jimi Hendrix version of the Star Spangled Banner. You know, it shows the fractured state of American politics right now. And that's why the flag appears throughout the new book, Tom's linoleum etching. So that's Tom is a good translator, but also a graphic designer. So,
but what is the other language besides English? Tom, what did you translate it into?
I translated it into Dutch. So in Belgium, we have, in fact, 3 languages. We have the Dutch in the northern part, in the southern part we have French, and in the eastern part we have German. And my maternal language is, my native language is Dutch, in fact. So it's a translation into Dutch.
As well as being an artist, you are a literary translator, and we're going to be hearing more about that. So Richard, give us a taste of the book with an opening poem.
Okay. I was reading a lot of, I was going to do a little bit of from the introduction because it's Camus and he's railing against capital punishment in one of his novels, The Stranger. But this little poem, this introductory poem is called Camus Redux. And Tom was good enough to get the French. We worked in French sometimes. And then he did a Dutch translation of the epigraph by Albert Camus from The Plague. Seemed an appropriate book to take a reference from. So this is the Camus epigraph. It says, "The plague bacillus never dies or vanishes entirely. It can remain dormant for dozens of years in furniture or clothing. It waits patiently in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, handkerchiefs, and old papers, and perhaps the day will come when, for the instruction or misfortune of mankind, the plague will rouse its rats and send them to die in some well-contented city," unquote. The poem goes, like New York. Hitler dead, Mussolini gone, Pétain in the ash can of history, but the rats are out again, Nova virus, Nova fascism. Can we muster the compassion Camus felt in the middle of it all, his sympathy for humanity, at the risk of turning evil into a banality, as Hannah Arendt would have it? Disease, separation, and exile come upon us unexpectedly, absurdly, and the only way to fight the plague is with decency, Camus tells us. But how can we not blame our country now, left and right? How can we find the will to resist compromise, to survive, to love?
So that's the voice of Richard Hartice, and he is the poet of love, really. And also he can draw a sharp sword with our society. It's all in this book. But I think that Merwin said it was not possible to translate. Translating is impossible, but yet we do it. Tom, how do you do it? You read the poem first, and then what do you do?
Well, first of all, I find it very important to have a lot of meetings with Richard to talk about the poem. And then I can make a good translation, I think. And I want to hear also a nice voice in the poem, together with the correct meaning of the words.
So do you do it in flat English first and then make it into a poem?
Well,
or do you go line by line? And do you change it line by line, syllable by syllable?
Or do you? For example, sometimes you can find a word that has a nice meaning, a nice sound, similar to the meaning of English in English. And then I choose that word, and it has to sound also fluent. And the correct meaning is, of course, perhaps sometimes there are some expressions in the book that I don't know. And then I asked Richard, what does that mean? And then I can give layers to the poem also in Dutch, into Dutch.
It is sounds really hard. It sounds as if it's very time intensive, and it sounds really as if it's work. It's pure work. How do you find joy in this?
Well, maybe because of the language of Richard's poems, and because I know Richard, I see him as a good friend, and that makes things more easy.
That's a great answer. That is a great answer. So
excuse me, Grace. This book has won the Valentin Krustev Award for translation. We give it every 2 years. And, you know, I don't speak Dutch, but Tom comes highly recommended. And I know his own poetry. I remember meeting him in Macedonia on a lake there. And he read a poem, a Jungian poem about the id. And it made me sure that this was somebody I wanted to work with.
So that is good. So important. That I think that relationship has a lot to do with the success of the translation. I really do, because he mentions his friendship. So that it's really turning over your own ego and your own identity in service, isn't it? In service. And Richard, let us hear you both together then. If Richard will read a poem, and then Tom will either, I hear that he can sing it even. So that will be special. So let's do that. Richard, tell us, set up your poem.
This poem is called Crow, Grace, and it points out one of the interesting things. Apparently, the crows in Belgium speak a different language than the American crows. In my poem, the crow keeps saying, craw, craw, you know, it's time to get up, get going. But in Dutch, it's kier, kier, I think. It's sort of a different word, but the same idea. Anyway, this is called Crow. There is a crow complaining in the yard. Black thoughts in the green grass. He makes his imitation duck noises, like calling the hunters hiding in the blind. Is he looking for a little aged roadkill, or just hopping around, letting the earthworms know an earthquake is about to occur? Mostly, he just seems bored. Normal crow attitude. He'd like to know what we're thinking, folded in each other's arms when the sun has almost peaked overhead. He's not sure he likes this leisure, the state of the world as the globe slows its spinning. Caw, caw! Time to rise and shine.
Time to rise and shine. Tom, take us away.
Er is een kraai aan het zakken in de tuin. Zwarte gedachten in het groene gras. Hij imiteert eendengeluiden, zoals het roepen van de jagers die zich volledig verstoppen. Is hij op zoek naar wat klein, oud, aangereden wild? Of huppelt hij enkel rond met de boodschap aan de aardwormen dat er een aardbeving zal plaatsvinden? Meestal lijkt hij alleen verveeld, wat normaal voor een kraai is. Hij zou graag weten wat we denken, geguld in elkaars armen, wanneer de zon boven ons bijna het hoogste punt heeft bereikt. Hij is niet zeker of hij van dit plezier houdt, of van de toestand van de wereld, zoals de aardbol zijn draaien vertraagt. Cow, cow, time to rise and shine. Cow, cow, time to rise and shine.
Now we know how rise and shine is said in Dutch, which we never knew before. That, did you ever put any of the other songs and poems to music, Tom?
No, I didn't, but I just wanted to tell that it's nice that I can do that for Richard, but sometimes it's not easy to find the right chords for the. It's something that has to come, and I'm very happy that I have the agreement of the authentication of Richard that I can do that with his poem too.
That's great. So this poem just lent itself very well to chords, maybe because of the one syllable words or something like that. I want to tell everyone who you both are, and I'm going to start with Tom because he is from Catholic University. That's where you studied in Belgium, and you were a literary scholar. You work on literary subjects. But in addition, we did not know that you were this artist. And the book is filled with truly magnificent art. I would love to cut out those pages and frame every one of them, Tom. So you are multidimensional. And have you ever translated anyone else before this?
Yes, I translated some poems into German because I studied also German, and then I wanted to do that. But as Richard shows, my father and grandfather had a printing office and grandfather. So this is a little bit the nature of my family.
That is beautiful. That's a print, yeah. That's a linoleum cut. Well, Richard has so many facets to him. He's a poet. He's a novelist. He's the president of a very important organization, the William Meredith Foundation. Meredith was the United States Poet Laureate, and he has been a physician's assistant. He was in North Africa and spent his Fulbright year, and I guess in Bulgaria?
Yes.
Is that where you met Tom? I know that you have a citizenship.
Met in Macedonia at the Lake Ohrid at the Struga Poetry Festival.
It sounds so exotic.
Years ago.
You've written 14 books of prose and poetry. You've edited and published 14 books with other people here and abroad. Okay, but now there's a new dimension to your world, and that is the film Comes Love, which is going to be produced by the Hollywood Dreams Film Festival. Wow. Richard, I know there's no thing on paper that you cannot do. You are really the man of all seasons. So let's give us a poem. Set it up, Richard, and tell us what we're going to hear.
Yeah, the first film, by the way, was called Marathon, and it was based on an autobiography, and it was on Netflix, and it's still around. I mean, that's what got me interested in film. But this poem is called Summer Lantern, and I have a house out in the river, Thames River. We say Thames here in Connecticut to distinguish from the mother country, Thames. But I also live in Groton, which in senior housing. So, yeah, I have a winter place because they plow the parking lot, and there's a pool cord in case you have a gallbladder need or a heart attack or something. So it's a comfortable place to be in the winter. Connecticut can be very Arctic. But this poem is called Summer Lantern for Andrew. Here at senior housing, the first firefly of summer sets off his torch over the field. Love, 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 electric on the night. And at the edge of the field, a little Bambi with white spots, about the tiniest deer ever, hanging out with her mother until she sees me and hightails it, not fully white yet, into the forest. When we were children, grown Bambis, we would crouch underneath the fireflies to see them against the evening sky and flap them down, blinking there in the grass, to put into a bottle with holes at the top and a little grass to make a summer lantern. This virus has slapped me down. I'm in a jar blinking with all the other old people, remembering summer, what it has been and what it may yet be with the first firefly of summer.
Oh, remembering summer. There's so much in your poetry that is just warm and makes us feel so much. There's nothing in the world you cannot write about. Tom, as you hear that poem, do you remember translating it?
Yes, it was very interesting. There were, I think, I will see it, three parts of it. And that was very interesting to see. I will look back because three parts in it. And I liked the image of the animals in it. And I don't know, I don't see much, many fireflies here. So that was.
Oh, do you know what it is though? Do you know what a firefly is? We call them lightning bugs.
Right.
Yes, it's very nice to see. And I looked it up on the internet, but it was very nice. And to see that image of the fireflies was very nice to me.
So you learned a lot, Tom, working with Richard. We all do. Okay, Richard, do the work. Read a couple of poems.
Well, here's the one called Pepperoni. And
I said you could write about anything.
This, you know, the pandemic, when people live together and, you know, a lot of tensions, with luck, we're turning the corner. But I had a roommate here, Mike, and this poem's about him. He disappeared, I think, too much togetherness meant for a kind of a COVID casualty. But we're still friends, but he no longer helps me and lives here. But anyway, for a long time he did. This poem is called Pepperoni. Whenever it's on sale, which is always, Mike buys one bag of pepperoni so he can get the second one free. When you open the dangerous door of our refrigerator now, bags of pepperoni fall out like frogs from heaven. It isn't a bargain if you don't need it, my dad always said. How much pepperoni can two guys and a dog eat? Quote, I'll go to the bank and get wine and salmon for tonight's party, I text Mikey. And shrimp, he texts back. In the immortal words of Mick Jagger, you can't always get what you want, Mikey, you get what you need. But you are sweet, and a nor'easter is about to blow down on us. I guess we need shrimp, and maybe some pepperoni.
That is a relationship poem for sure. Let's hear another.
This comes later in the, let's say, these were plague poems. I'll read you some new ones at the end, but this is called Saturday, Holy Week. It's coming up again soon. And it has an epigraph by Percy Bysshe Shelley, which goes, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. And the poem goes, I guess the world really will return to some kind of normal afterwards, the way trees and ferns fanned out in primavera glory after the bubonic plague. I'll fly away for sure someday, as will we all. And what will the world make of my little spirit, which has walked a while among others walking this poor burgeoning planet? The day before his resurrection, what was he thinking? I have always wondered. Before the angel descended and rolled away the great rock keeping him in the dark, dreaming of the gates of hell as his blood pooled beneath him, here lies one whose name was writ in water, Keats requested for his tombstone. In fact, the poem seemed written blood, indelible, despite the fact he turned to ashes there on the Spanish steps. Quote, nothing matters, my mother's friend pronounced as she lay dying. The dead in Italy and all over the world would agree. The mystery of being, can it possibly end? Can it possibly matter? This our dark rumination, as we lie on stone with our brother, waiting for the light.
Richard, The reason I'm a big fan is because you will write about everything. You will find the truth in a firefly. You will bring in your mother's friend. You will bring in what your sister says. Everything that happens is material for poetry with you. Everything you see, everything you feel, everything you overhear, where did you get the freedom to gather all that in the world and make it yours? Where did you get that?
Well, as my friend Grace Cavallari says, I just keep writing them.
But you just keep seeing them. You just keep seeing the deer. You just keep seeing the pepperoni. As William Carlos Williams said about a little piece of glass in the driveway of the hospital, when he wrote about that little piece of glass, I knew we were able to do everything, but you have taken it to a new level. So you were extraordinary.
Richard Wilbur, poor Richard, before he died, he said, that's what an aesthetic, nothing but in things.
William, what William said.
No, this was
William Carlos Williams.
Right, that was his aesthetic. And Wilbur at one point said, that's what's good about your work, because you know, you realize that it's only, you have to have things. It's things that people connect to, whether it's that piece of glass you're talking about or, you know, a bag of pepperoni. It's just lucky, Gracie, to have this penchant for looking at things and including things. And I don't, you know, somebody asked William one time, where does poetry come? Well, that's a perpetual question. Where does poetry come from? And, you know, God or too many drugs, whatever. I mean, some chemical ability in the brain to connect things. My belief has always been that poetry is metaphor, is the guiding engine for poetry. Mm. You see one thing and you think another. In other words,
wonderful.
You know, you see the moon and you think of, you know, a hole in the night, in the black fabric of night, you know.
That's everything. That is everything, what you've just said. That's the script.
You know, that and, you know, metaphor and then love, too, enters. You know, it's not just the things, those trigger, but then something else is triggered when you focus on things. And that other thing is love or a sentiment, a kind of an appreciation of things.
Oh, know?
And that's the mystery. That's what you try to convey. But I don't
know. The noticing is the appreciation in a way.
And the it leads to something larger, which can be the human spirit. You know.
But nothing less will do, but it's the seeing first, to see it first.
See, that's right. That's mm-hmm. right. The way you do, Grace, in your own painting, you know, you look at a particular color or a shape or putting these things together, and it's the putting together of the thing that makes for the beauty of the work.
It's everything. The world is random, Richard. We know that. So what we do is take those random pepperonis and those random pieces of red and make art. Tom, your art is incredibly beautiful. You find freedom in art. Translation is not freedom, let's face it. It's a straitjacket with a dose of vodka. But you, your work, your paintings, tell us about how you can express so easily.
Well, first of all, I think translation is also a kind of appreciation. It's also enjoying what someone else has written and respect that. That's for me very important to translate. And about creating etchings or, I don't know, the linoleum cuts or like that, it's interesting. I think it's a little bit the same as poetry. You do it with your heart, with a feeling, and then you hope that other people can get a feeling about your work. And I don't think you can time, you can't manage that. It's difficult. So you put your own feeling into your work because you feel you have to do it that way. You have to write it that way if you're a writer. And then maybe you don't have hope, but if someone else sees your work and it does something with that other person, then it's okay.
That's why art makes us less lonely, because it does something to that other person. Well, Richard, give us another poem.
Well, as I mentioned, it gets pretty Arctic here in Connecticut. So this poem is called Snow Day. You know, when kids don't have to go to school because there's too much snow, you know, and the buses can't get around and everything. So this poem is called Snow Day. The cars are all blanketed in snow. Windshield wipers turned up against freezing like antlers. The parking lot has become a herd of reindeer. The dog tiptoes gingerly on the diamond crust but sinks up to her chin when the snow gives way and she must hop like a kangaroo to escape the field. Quote, the mind contemplating snow is the true mind, the poet tells us. The mind figuring out how to shovel yourself out when the snow plow plows you in is a blizzard afterthought. If I have a ham and a loaf of bread, Mother always said, I can survive a storm. I've got both, thanks to Meals on Wheels, who miraculously has made it through, like the U.S. Postal Service. Forget black ice for the moment. Turn on a faux fireplace on the TV and pour yourself a stiff eggnog. Everyone deserves a snow day. Put on your slippers, take out the novel you've been meaning to get to, make a hot ham sandwich, and let tomorrow take care of itself.
Richard Hartize. Richard Hartize. The title of the book is what?
Pandemie.
Pandemie. We can see what that means. Pandemic. Yeah. Right. But, you know,
side by side, Dutch translations of this book. You know, a friend said, well, why are you putting them into Dutch? Everybody in Holland speaks English. Well, yes and no. And the point is, there are some things that can be said in another language that only can be had in that language. The French, for example, when you use the word coq in a French poem, well, the rooster is loaded with meaning for a French person, and so it's not. There's connotation and denotation, and the denotation is it's a rooster, but the connotation is far deeper than that for a French person, because it pulls up, you know, a whole lifetime of language. So I think that in Dutch, on occasion, Tom has been able to create translations which speak to a Dutch audience in a way that they couldn't be reached in English. I'd have to speak Dutch well enough to show you a good example of that. But I think that's the value of Tom's work here, because, you know, it's a cliche, but if we didn't have translation, we'd never understand what Dostoevsky was all about, or Racine, or Shakespeare, for that matter, if we couldn't at least make an attempt to show what the other culture and the other spirit has created, has achieved, then would be much less rich as a culture, you know?
It's not only about that. It's not only about the beauty and the layers and the richness, but it is essential to make bridges to other culture. And using the art then involves feelings, which are different from op-eds, you know, that are translated. And this is a service, I think it's a holy work. It's holy work, as far as I'm concerned. So you hit it right on the head, Richard. But back to the snow poem, you have made so many people permanent in your poetry. Your mother with her loaf of bread, you know, that is quite miraculous that you mention what someone has said. Now that is making that person permanent forever. You draw tiny miniature portraits of people that way, by what they say, by what your father says. I think that's a lesson to other poets, but some just don't have the penchant or the relationship.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but the one quote in there is from William, and it's the mind contemplating snow is the true mind. Now that's a real nutmegger, Connecticut person, you know. When you know, when you can feel the snow is going
that's
to come.
Zen, man, that is zen.
The temperature is dropping, something in the air, some electric in the air, you know, snow is coming. The mind contemplating snow is the true mind. So it's when you're able to really get what's going on around you in nature, that makes it, you know, that makes it I don't know, real interesting, shall we say. But the mind contemplating, it's a great line, the mind contemplating snow is the true mind. And you're right, it is sort of Zen or Eckhart Tolle or, you know, or Mary Baker Eddy, you know, that there's a Christian Science, there's another reality. It's that person standing on your shoulder who's watching you. That's the real mind.
The loaf of bread is not a bad quote. That line from your mother, what does she say?
Right. If I can have a loaf of a ham and a loaf of bread, I can survive a storm, you know.
No, that's almost as important to me, because it's so colloquial, it is so down home, so accessible to us. The way you do have a philosophical and the actual in a poem is, I think, what has made you the great poet that you are.
Oh, thank you, Grace. I don't know. I just keep writing them, as Gracie says, you know.
Don't stop now. So describe the book a little bit more about how many illustrations are in there and who are some of the other artists.
Great. Well, here's the roster. There's young Tom at the top. And then there's Rita Dolly, who's a board member. And then they've changed her name, Patnode. She married Mark Patnode. So these are three artists whose work graces the book. And let me here's a wild one from Rita. Get a load of this. I mean, how scary is that? You know, this is like the
that's the pandemic. That's the pandemic.
Yeah, that's the pandemic. And the last image in the book is this white lily that Junior Patnode has created. And in the introduction, I talk about that poem, that image.
That's a good introduction, and it's also translated into Dutch. Right. And it's a very, very comprehensive introduction about the art and the purpose and the feeling of the poems.
The soft, somewhat romantic images harmonize with the surrealistic painting, sometimes humorous, sometimes severe, even disturbing, which our local shaman Rita Dolly has created as a response to the pandemic. But at one point I'm talking about, well, okay, this section ends with a final image of hope and resurrection, a last final word. Even when its roots are in the dirtiest waters, the lotus produces the most beautiful flower, an ancient symbol of rebirth, purity, and regeneration, self-regeneration. It calls for spiritual enlightenment so direly needed in these troubling times when all of life is threatened. And that's what this image attempts to be. It's
redemption, yeah.
And purity, and the irony, the lotus blooms out of the dirtiest waters, you know, so out of mud.
Art comes from a pandemic. And now we're going to ask that you read a restorative, redemptive poem about spring. And I'm going to ask Tom to read it first in Dutch, and that Good. You will follow in English. Would that be fine?
Great.
Plotseling lente. Heeft iemand ze geplant? Of is het leven op mysterieuze wijze zichzelf vernieuwend binnen en buiten de tijd, zoals God? Krokussen verschijnen in de natte aarde, zoals de adem van eeuwigheid. Het ligt achter ons.
Well, we've had this Delta virus, Delta read, what shall I call it? It's kind of a reconfiguration, which has delayed spring a little bit here. This was when we were thinking we were around the corner, and then the Delta variant sort of sidetracked us. But spring will come again, and I think this poem will be apt in a couple of months. It's called Suddenly Spring. Has someone planted them? Or is it life mysteriously renewing itself inside and outside of time, like God? Crocus appear in the damp earth like the breath of eternity. We are over it. And let's pray that we'll soon be over it, truly over it.
That is Richard Hartigues with Tom Bays, the translator, in collaboration with a beautiful book, Poet's Choice Publishers. And this is the program, The Poet and the Poem, from the Library of Congress.
Poets-choice.com.
Post-production for this program is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. And we wish to thank the Library of Congress for making it possible, and our funders, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and the Sinipet Fund. We thank you very much. Mike is our engineer, Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Thank you, Grace.
Thank you very much.